This is SBS World News Radio. I'm Greg Dyatt.
And I'm Andrina Hoff. Coming up, Nick Xenophon says the dual citizenship saga has nothing to do with his decision to quit federal politics.
I would have made this announcement earlier were it not for the High Court case. The High Court case has been a terrible distraction.
Nick Xenophon says he'll be running in the South Australian state election early next year.
Also this evening, after last night's 1-1 draw, the Socceroos are confident of a better performance in Tuesday night's rematch against Syria.
We'll go back to Australia now and we'll get the job done there.
And we'll preview the weekend in sport.
All those stories and more coming up in the next 30 minutes.
Good evening. With the news at 6 o'clock, I'm Andrina Hoff. Nick Xenophon has announced he will resign from the Senate to run for the seat of Hartley in the South Australian election. Senator Xenophon says he will wait for the High Court decision on the dual citizenship status of politicians before running his South Australian campaign. But he insists that he will run in the state election, no matter what.
I want to do the most I can. This is the way I can do things better. I have fewer staff. I know all that. But I can actually achieve much more at a state level, still working closely with my federal colleagues. So I think that the state is at a crossroad. Now is the time, now is the opportunity to actually make a real difference to bring about some deep and lasting reforms for the state.
Federal politicians have been quick to accuse the Nick Xenophon team leader of making the move out of self-interest rather than concern for South Australian citizens. However, Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young has wished her fellow South Australian good luck, saying more diversity was a good thing. Cardinal George Pell will face a 4-week committal hearing next March as he battles historical sexual offence charges. The third most senior Vatican official has appeared in the Melbourne Magistrates Court for a brief hearing. A hearing date has been set for March 5 to decide if there is enough evidence for him to stand trial. 50 witnesses are expected to give evidence at that hearing. A lawyer for Cardinal Pell says he will plead not guilty to all charges. His lawyers are expected to argue that some of the allegations could not have happened. 51,000 unregistered guns collected by authorities across the country are to be destroyed. The firearms were collected during the country's first national firearms amnesty since the Port Arthur massacre gun reforms introduced in 1996. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull says tragedies like the shooting in Las Vegas shows the importance of strict gun laws.
We've seen the shocking tragedy in Las Vegas. The killer there had a collection of semi-automatic weapons which a person in his position would simply not be able to acquire in Australia. So we have strict gun control laws, but we don't take anything for granted. We're not complacent about it. We've got 51,000 firearms have been handed in.
The powerful US gun lobby has called for more regulation on certain gun devices after the Las Vegas shooting. The National Rifle Association has called for regulators to determine whether so-called bump stock devices comply with federal law. The device was attached to the 12 semi-automatic rifles used by gunman Stephen Paddock to turn the guns into fully automatic weapons. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders says President Donald Trump welcomes a discussion on the devices.
Members of both parties in multiple organizations are planning to take a look at bump stocks and related devices. We certainly welcome that, would like to be part of that conversation, and we would like to see a clear understanding of the facts, and we'd like to see input from the victims' families, from law enforcement, from policymakers, and we're expecting hearings and other important fact-finding efforts on that, and we want to be part of that discussion. We're certainly open to that moving forward.
Investigators are still working to uncover what motivated Mr. Paddock, a well-off retiree and avid gambler, to assemble an arsenal of firearms, ammunition and explosives before opening fire on the 20,000-strong crowd attending a music festival. Reports have emerged that he may have been planning to attack sites in other US cities as well. Officials say all 58 people killed in the attack have now been identified and their families notified. To sport now, and Socceroos coach Ange Postecoglou says he's frustrated his team missed opportunities to win their World Cup qualifier playoff against Syria in Malaysia last night. With 5 minutes left to play, Australia were on the cusp of victory in the first leg of their playoff tie. But a controversial late penalty goal gave the war-ravaged nation the 1-1 equaliser they needed to cancel Robbie Cruz's 40th-minute opener in Malacca. Postecoglou says it is disappointing.
Yeah, enough chance to go two up and kill the game off, and again, we're kind of a goalpost away from doing that. So boys tried awfully hard. Last 20 minutes became a little bit chaotic and they got into the game. But, you know, we still defended really strongly. And, yeah, Matty pulled off a couple of good saves, which was good to see. It was just a bit, like I said, a bit disappointing to concede a goal like we did from a decision.
And now to tomorrow's weather. Perth will see a shower or two and 17. Morning showers for Adelaide, 25 degrees. Melbourne will be mostly sunny and 23. Hobart will see a possible light morning shower and 18. Mostly sunny in Canberra and 21. 20 degrees in Wollongong and partly cloudy. Similar conditions again for Sydney and 21 degrees. 21 in Newcastle, also cloudy. A shower or two for Brisbane and 24. Cairns will be cloudy with a possible shower and 31. And Darwin will see the chance of a shower or storm and 33 degrees. And Greg, more on those stories coming up on SBS World News at 6:30.
Thanks, Andrea. Right across Australia, this is SBS World News Radio. As you heard there in the news, the outspoken Senator Nick Xenophon denies that he's quitting federal parliament because of the ongoing dual citizenship saga. He's revealed he'll be calling it a day to run in the South Australian state election early next year. From Canberra, Maria Civic reports.
Ever since he was first elected to state parliament 20 years ago, Nick Xenophon's been known as a political stuntman. He served for a decade in his home state of South Australia before transitioning to federal parliament, and now he's going back.
I've decided that you can't fix South Australia's problems in Canberra without first fixing our broken system, our broken political system back home. I don't want this coming election to signify nothing. I don't want the next 4 years to be more of the same broken, dysfunctional politics with Labor or Liberal in government, but nothing really changing.
The outspoken senator will quit the Senate and run in the seat of Hartley in Adelaide's East at the next state election in March. He says he's been thinking about it for months after being spurred on by South Australia's high unemployment rate, declining population and the statewide blackout earlier this year. The current local MP for the seat of Hartley, Vincent Tarsia, says he's unfazed about going up against a political veteran.
Well, look, I'm not the one having to run a federal party or a state party. I'm the one out there in the community. And I have already had a lot of concerns from those in the community at the moment. They're saying to me, how is he going to, you know, run a state party, run a federal party, and be a marginal seat campaigner? Because let me tell you, it is a mighty task and it takes, you know, over 80 hours a week.
Senator Xenophon was re-elected to the Senate at last year's federal election, along with two senators and, in a first for his NXT party, an MP in the lower house. He denies his decision to quit the Senate has been prompted by the ongoing dual citizenship saga in federal politics. He's one of seven politicians caught up in the drama, and the High Court will begin hearing submissions on their cases next week.
I will remain in the Senate fighting for the state until the High Court determines the outcome of the so-called citizenship case affecting me and six others to be heard next week. While my lawyers are confident I will succeed, whatever the outcome, once that decision is handed down, I will be in a position to leave the Senate. I would have made this announcement earlier were it not for the High Court case. The High Court case has been a terrible distraction, but the constitutional position is clear, the legal advice I've obtained is clear. I should win that case, but it's up to the women and men of the High Court.
While congratulating him on the move, opposition leader Bill Shorten took a thinly veiled swipe at deals done under Senator Xenophon's watch.
He's a very decent and pleasant fellow to deal with, although I do understand that Nick Xenophon has done more dud deals with Malcolm Turnbull than anyone ought to put up with, so maybe he's decided no more of that, time to move on to greener pastures.
Government Senator and Education Minister Simon Birmingham did much the same.
Well, the ultimate attention seeker is pulling another giant publicity stunt. Nick Xenophon, who in 2007 cut and run from the South Australian Parliament just 18 months into an eight-year term, saying that state politics was largely irrelevant and all the power resided in Canberra, is now cutting and running from the federal parliament just 12 months into a six-year term, saying he wants to come back to South Australia.
But Nick Xenophon says as leader of the NXT party, he'll still play an active role in decisions made at a federal level.
This will be the toughest political fight of my life. But I'm up for that challenge because I love our state, our people, and I believe that if you are in politics, you should be there to make a difference. I don't expect it will be easy. I expect that this will be like climbing Mount Everest without an oxygen tank, but I will do this.
His Senate seat will be filled by a new NXT candidate.
Maria Civic with that report. This is SBS World News Radio with Greg Dyett, 10 past 6. Coming up a little later, Australian commanders in the Middle East say the country's commitment to supporting war-torn Afghanistan will last for decades.
The mission in Afghanistan remains to deny Afghanistan becoming a safe haven for terrorism again, but as a part of that mission, we're of course helping the Afghan government become sort of well-established, and we're enhancing their ability, whether that's in planning skills or the ability to sustain their forces or advice on tactics.
That story from Miles Morgan coming up. 13 past 6. Momentum is building for at least some gun control in the United States following the Las Vegas mass shooting. Some key Republican politicians and the National Rifle Association say they're open to a crackdown on a device the gunman used. It's known as a bump stock, and it allows a semi-automatic rifle to function as if it was fully automatic. Correspondent Maggie Palmer has covered the aftermath of this week's shooting from Las Vegas. She says there have been mixed reactions to the NRA's calls for additional regulations on bump stocks.
Some are very excited today because the key gun lobby here in America has come out in favour of some restrictions at least. But then there is also sceptics here who are sort of saying, well, hang on, the National Rifle Association is in favour of restricting the sale of one piece of equipment, one small piece of equipment that the shooter did use in this incident, which, as you say, allows you to fire more rounds more quickly. But people who want serious gun reform here in America say that is just not enough. And if the NRA thinks that they get out of jail free card, so to speak, in terms of not having to tighten the legislation on the other bigger issues, then they've got another thing coming. So certainly in Washington, a lot of discussion and a lot of debate about this exact issue over the coming weeks for sure.
What have you heard in the last day or so about Paddock? There was some suggestion, although the police didn't go into it, that he may have had some sort of escape route planned from the Mandalay Bay casino.
Yeah, so we know that he was very meticulous in organising this shooting and the logistics around that. Police saying that they have found a car which they understand was the shooter's. Also, we know that he had surveillance cameras set up using a baby monitor as one of the cameras. So he sort of rigged them up throughout his room in the hotel, including on a like a hospitality trolley out the front of his room, so as to alert him should authorities try to enter his room. So clearly this was a very calculated attack. Police have also said that they've found a note in his room. They won't reveal what's in that note, but they are certainly looking at the details of that letter that he left behind very closely to try and get a little bit closer to understanding the motive that caused this massacre.
Last night you told us that a week before the massacre, he had actually booked another room at another hotel in a different part of Vegas. But in the last 24 hours, we've heard that he booked two rooms in Chicago. He didn't show up there. But again, these rooms looked out onto the location of a music festival.
Exactly right, exactly right. So someone with the exact same name as the shooter has booked hotels in the past in and around the vicinity of other music festivals, which has left the FBI investigating, like, why did he do that? Was he planning to do this attack previously? Was he scoping out the logistics so he could orchestrate this most recent attack better? They're not quite sure, but they're scouring the country to speak to any family, friends, associates of the shooter to get a better picture of who he was, what was going through his mind, and what on earth could cause someone to do this.
Maggie, when the shooting first occurred, or shortly after the shooting, IS was quick to claim responsibility, and there was the reaction, oh, well, IS can easily claim responsibility for things that's got nothing to do with. Mm-hmm. Interesting, though, we're hearing from some sources in the United States, well, maybe we shouldn't just discount that out of hand just yet.
That's right. So ISIS has released a form of a newsletter that they release semi-regularly. And today, again, they're standing by their claim that they have taken responsibility for this mass shooting here in the United States. They're claiming that this shooter converted about 6 months ago now. Now, I should point out that there is no proof of this other than IS's statement at this stage. The FBI are saying that they have no evidence to suggest that that is correct, but certainly this is definitely a line of investigation that they're looking at very thoroughly.
Maggie Palmer on the line there from Las Vegas, 17 past 6. Top-ranking Australian commanders in the Middle East say the country's commitment to supporting war-torn Afghanistan will last for decades. Australian soldiers have been in Afghanistan almost continually for the past 16 years, and it's become the country's longest-running war. The commitment is being described as flexible but enduring. Miles Morgan has our story.
The Australian Defence Force has approximately 300 people in Afghanistan, about half of them in a combat-oriented force protection role. The rest are completing the train, advise and assist mission the ADF committed to in 2015, when conventional combat operations ended. The commander of Australian forces in the Middle East, Major General John Frewen, says Australia cannot let Afghanistan accommodate terrorism again.
The mission in Afghanistan remains to deny Afghanistan becoming a safe haven for terrorism again, but as a part of that mission, we're of course helping the Afghan government become sort of well established, and we're enhancing their ability, whether that's in planning skills or the ability to sustain their forces or advice on tactics. This isn't us turning up telling them how we think they should do business. Of course, these operations have been going on for many years now. We are very much focused on specific skill sets and capabilities that they see as priorities.
The Afghan government and security forces are fighting enemies like the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and a young Islamic State Khorasan province. The country's south is particularly vulnerable. The Australian commander in Afghanistan, Brigadier Michael Prichter, says little over half the country's population is under government control.
Yeah, the official position is about 60% of the population, or 60 to 64% of the population, is secured by the government. The Taliban control about 10%, and the rest is contested. And the aim over the next 4 years is to get from about 60% to about 80%, and then reconcile in some way with the Taliban. The Taliban ultimately need to be convinced that they cannot win in Afghanistan. They are probably part of the solution at some point in the future, but they need to be convinced that they cannot win.
The ADF wants to convince the Taliban by training a new generation of Afghan army officers, improving coordination between the security forces and reducing corruption. Another key component is building the capability of the Afghan Air Force and Special Forces. But Major General Frewen says mentoring doesn't mean a return to combat for Australian troops.
At the moment, we are supporting the Afghan government. The Afghan government's aims are fundamental in what the ADF does there. This is not our fight in the first instance. We are there supporting the Afghan people in their fight. So there is absolutely no requirement for us to be involved in combat roles directly in Afghanistan right now.
The Australian military is based around the capital city of Kabul, spread between the airport, the military academy and the diplomatic zone. Soldiers like Brigadier Craig Short, a former commander of Australia's elite commando unit, are also embedded in the NATO headquarters as part of the wider mission. He's one of the highest ranking officers there.
If we looked at this time last year, there were four provincial capitals under attack. Kunduz, Tarankout, Lashkargah and Farah. This year, under Op Mansouri, the Taliban have been unable to actually sustain an attack against any of those capitals.
He says that is a sign of progress, not victory, and support for the government and security forces needs to be sustained.
By providing support to each one of those respective pillars, I think you'll find the campaign will start to evolve, where we'll start to see the capabilities being developed and then applied to combat operations, creating, if you like, an irreversible momentum to ensure that, you know, we drive the Taliban, ISK and the like to reconcile, and if not, they'll be defeated in detail.
The Australian military has been in Afghanistan almost continuously since 2001. The United States-led coalition invaded the country in response to the September 11 attacks that year. The idea of an Australian withdrawal has been floated often, especially as troop numbers decreased 10 years into the war. But now Australian military commanders like Brigadier Prichter aren't talking about an exit.
There will be an enduring commitment to support the Air Force. And we are currently growing an Air Force of about 390 aircraft for the Afghan security forces. Now, that will take, you can't walk away from that in a couple of years, so that will be an enduring commitment. It may look very different from what we are doing now. It may, you know, the numbers may shift. You know, right now the numbers are going up because we're going back into the schools. But there will be a presence here for a long time to come, I think.
Major General John Fruin says the ADF is in Afghanistan at the request of the Afghan government, and it will mentor the Afghan forces through a volatile few years.
There is a very clear timeline moving towards 2020. Next year, Afghanistan will undertake regional elections for the first time, and then the year after that, they will have national elections again. So there are some clear milestones along that path, and we will be able to gauge, to take some pretty good measures along the way of where Afghanistan is going to be over the next couple of years. Over time, whether there is a natural path for sort of drawing down those capabilities, we'll of course, monitor that very closely. But again, it will be about what the Afghan government want us to do.
Major General John Fruin ending that report from Miles Morgan. A controversial penalty decision has denied Australia a key World Cup qualifying victory over Syria in football in Malaysia. Instead, the 1-1 draw means the Socceroos' chances to advance in the qualifiers now rest on Tuesday night's rematch between the two teams in Sydney. Samantha Beniak-Brooks has more.
Australia looked set to win the first leg of its World Cup qualifying series with Syria, leading 1-0 5 minutes from the end of regular time. That was until Socceroos Matthew Leckie leapt to stop Syria striker Omar Al-Samar from scoring and was hit with a penalty. Al-Samar then blasted home the 85th minute penalty shot to level the score and keep Syria's World Cup dream very much alive. The penalty has angered the Socceroos players, Leckie describing the call as very poor. But Robbie Cruz, who scored the lone Australian goal, says it's now time to look to the rematch on Tuesday night in Sydney.
I mean, he's headed the ball outside the box. He's jumped in the air and he's touched him. The guy's 6'5", and he's gone down pretty easy. So, I mean, you knew the referee wanted to give it. I think he almost blew it before he even went down. So we've had this ref before and you know what's going to be like. So it's disappointing. So we have to move on and look for the next game.
Australian coach Ange Postecoglou says the Australian side looked in good shape overall, but Syria hit back at the right time. Postecoglou's side must now show off its muscle to a side that has never qualified before. Syria may rank lower than the Socceroos, but it has moved up significantly in the FIFA rankings. Socceroos captain Mark Milligan says the side was unlucky, but will be able to win Tuesday night's game against Syria.
I think we're a little bit unlucky. I thought we dealt with the long direct play that they dealt up in the second half, you know, reasonably well. Not sure what happened with the pen. We dug deep in tough conditions and we'll go back to Australia now and we'll get the job done there.
Australia indeed appears confident as it heads into the second leg playoff. It will have the home goal advantage, meaning Syria must either beat the Socceroos to progress or, if they draw, score at least 2 goals. The winner of that game advances to a two-legged playoff against the fourth-place side from the group covering North and Central America and the Caribbean. The opponent for that game in November has not been determined. The winner in that November playoff would then get a spot at next year's World Cup finals in Russia.
Samantha Beniak-Brooks with that report. Staying with the sports theme now, there's the return this weekend of football's A-League and the National Basketball League, along with Formula One, the Bathurst 1000 and cricket. And taking a look ahead, here's John Baldock.
Football's A-League returns tonight with Melbourne City taking on the Brisbane Roar in the season opener. And Melbourne plays host to the weekend's biggest fixture when the Victory take on Sydney FC in a repeat of last season's grand final. Sydney FC is aiming to become the first team to win back-to-back A-League titles, and coach Graham Arnold says he and the players believe they can do it.
You know, these boys are a group of winners. We've bred that in them. We've got a special culture at this club, a mateship, and we'll fight for each other the whole way. And so therefore, you know, with the belief that I have in the players, that they have in themselves, that we believe that we're in for another top season.
Melbourne Victory captain Carl Valeri, meanwhile, couldn't hide his excitement at the official season launch during the week.
It's going to be a great game, and it's exciting because, you know, it's a very long build-up for both teams involved and for the fans involved. So it's an exciting week, and, you know, just love days like this because it means the season is about to start.
Elsewhere, motorsport fans in Australia will have their attention turned to the Bathurst 1000 this weekend. For international motorsport lovers, the Japan Formula One Grand Prix will also get plenty of headlines. Australian driver Daniel Ricciardo is having a good season, as is his Red Bull teammate Max Verstappen. The talented Belgian won the team's first race of the season at the most recent Grand Prix in Malaysia, but he says nothing is guaranteed in Sunday's race at Suzuka.
We did really well in Malaysia, but it's not a guarantee that we will do really well here. But last year the car was very competitive, and I think we can be competitive again, but if we can fight for a victory, I don't know, because at the moment I think Ferrari is really strong still, and Mercedes, they always struggle a little bit in Malaysia because of the heat with the tyres. They are not so good on that. So for sure they will be very strong here again, but hopefully we can be quite close. You know, that would be a good achievement, I think.
The National Basketball League is underway. SBS and Viceland are broadcasting two live games in round one. On Saturday afternoon, the Sydney Kings take on the Adelaide 36ers in a game that can be seen on Viceland. Then on Sunday, SBS will have live coverage of the New Zealand Breakers versus the Cairns Taipans. In the early hours of Sunday morning, Australia's cricketers will face up to a dominant India side in the first of three T20 matches. After losing both the Test and One Day series, Steve Smith's side will be hoping to end the series on a winning note. Also on Sunday, Game 2 of the Constellation Cup netball series between Australia and New Zealand takes place. Australia won the opening match of the series on Thursday night by 3 points.
John Baldock with that look ahead to the weekend in sport. Well, time now to check the news headlines. And Catalan officials have accused Spain's constitutional court of infringing on their freedom of expression after it suspended a parliamentary session planned for Monday. At least 22 people have been killed by tropical storm Nate in Central America as it heads towards Mexico and the US Gulf Coast. And a report by the United Nations on children and armed conflict has revealed more than 8,000 children were killed and injured in conflicts across the world last year. Well, that's SBS World News Radio for now. You can see Mike Tomalaris bringing you SBS World News at 6:30. You can live stream The Bulletin these days on our website. Just go to sbs.com.au/news. There you'll find all our stories and content. You can also get it in your Facebook news feed. Just like our page, SBS World News. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @SBS News. I'm Greg Dyett. Thanks for listening.